Today, we're going to learn a class with some, I assume, known facts, known sources, but hopefully some other sources that are not so known. And the objective of the class today is to understand the relationship between non-Jews and the Ten Commandments. That's really the thing under the hood, so to speak. But some people think, erroneously, wrongly, that the Ten Commandments are for every single person in the world or humankind, and you know, Christianity brought it out to the whole world and so on. But the truth is that that's wrong. And I'll show you why it's wrong. It's very simple to understand why it's wrong. And instead of that, we have to understand what's the message of Judaism for non-Jews, which is actually pretty simple, the Seven Commandments and the ramifications and so on. But the main point is to understand that the Ten Commandments are not the general message of Judaism for non-Jews. Having said that, that doesn't mean that every single thing that appears in the Ten Commandments, it's not for non-Jews. What I mean is like this. Some ideas are for non-Jews also, but not because they are in the Ten Commandments. Rather, because we learned them from somewhere else, whatever the case is. We're not going to go into the whole list of the Ten Commandments and see each one and how do you learn each one and so on. That's not the point of this class. Rather, to understand that some ideas do apply to non-Jews and some ideas don't apply to non-Jews. And together with that, the idea is to bring some information regarding the holiday of Shavuos, which is coming this particular week, and what non-Jews could do, could not do, what to recommend and so on. That's the point of this class. So let's go, no more introductions, let's start. First of all, what is this holiday of Shavuot, Shavuos? My Ashkenazic pronunciation and so on makes it a little bit different, but whatever, it's the same idea. What is it? Point number one, when you look at the source, there are a few sources, but the Toyin Pashas Emor says very clearly that we're going to count 49 days after the holiday of Pesach, and the 50th day, that's going to be Shavuos. That's all basically the Torah says about it. We don't know exactly what happened in that day, what's the meaning of the day, what's the mysticism of the day, nothing. The Torah doesn't say anything. Doesn't say anything. To the point that our sages call it in the Talmud, Atzeres. Atzeres means like, don't do work. For Jews, this is talking about Jews. Don't do work. So we know we don't have to work on Shavuos, but the same thing applies to Pesach, the same thing applies to Sukkot and Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur. Whatever holiday in the Jewish tradition is exactly the same. Don't work. Whatever work means, we're not going to discuss this. So we don't see anything special in Shavuos. In Pesach, we see that we have matzah and we have to be careful with this and with that, whatever the different laws are. And in Sukkot, we know we have to build a hut, whatever that is. So many things. In Yom Kippur, we fast. In Rosh Hashanah, we blow the shofar, whatever it is. Shavuos, we don't do anything. When you continue reading this particular source, Parshas Emor, where the Torah, it's one of the places where the Torah talks about the holidays, it says basically that in the temple in Yerushalayim that we don't have today, it should be rebuilt speedily in our days, but today we don't have it. In the temple, there used to happen a few things in Shavuos. What? Different than other holidays. Besides the things that used to happen every single day, that every single day there used to be a korban, an offering in the morning and in the afternoon, and other things happening for every single Yom Tev holiday. In addition to that, there used to be two loaves of wheat bread, specifically wheat bread, and it had to be leavened bread. I didn't write it down, but it had to be leavened bread, interestingly. 49 days before, in Pesach, leavened bread is completely forbidden. It's a terrible transgression of the Torah for Jews. 49 days later, it is a mitzvah. Yes, you have to bring leavened bread from wheat. Interesting to know. We're not going to discuss why and so on, but such a thing happened in the temple, two loaves of bread, and a whole bunch of animals. I'm not going to read it. You know how to read English. So a whole bunch of animals that had to be brought together with this bread. And even though Shavuos is usually called Chag HaBikurim, the holiday of the first fruits, the truth is that at that moment in the year started the season, so to speak, to bring the first fruits. And it ended up in Hanukkah towards the summer. It ended up in Hanukkah, towards the winter, I'm sorry, towards the winter, ended up in Hanukkah. But there was a whole period of time that you could bring to the temple the first fruits of your fields and the crop and so on, which I'm not going to explain why, what, and so on, because it's not the point of this class. But basically, this is what Shavuos means when you read the text in the Torah. Nothing else. Then, our sages explain that after the 49 days, that means in the 50th day, basically, it could be learned in deeper understanding, but I'm not going to do it. I'm only saying the things that I'm not going to do. Whatever, for different classes. So what are we going to do? We'll see. You'll see. So our sages explained that in that particular 50th day, God gave the Torah to the Jewish people. So it's called Shavuos Chag Matan Torah. Torah saying whatever. The holiday of the giving of the Torah. That's another subject that happened in Shavuos. But when you look at the source in the Torah, that means Parshas Yisroi, Yitro, where it talks about the giving of the Torah, it doesn't really say, this is what happened in Shavuos. 2 points. Blah, 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 blah. God gave the Torah. No, it doesn't say that. It just says, you know, we came to this mountain in the beginning of the month. It doesn't even say which month. In the beginning of the month, so we, our sages have a whole learned, a whole teaching lesson, how to know which month it was, which day it was, what happened each day. There's a whole bunch of back and forth, Moshe Rabbeinu going up to the mountain, Mount Sinai, going down, up and down a few times with different messages from God. All kinds of things happen over there, but it doesn't really say which day happened what. It's not so clear. And our sages actually argue which day happened what, which day the Torah was given, in which day of the week the Torah was given. It's a whole argument in the Talmud, in Shabbos. But at the end of the day, in a general way, that's what happened in Shavuos. Activities in the temple, and there's a one point in history, which actually this is the basics and the most fundamental fact in history in the whole humankind, for Judaism and for non-Jews also, as we're going to learn later. But the point is that, again, in the Torah, a whole bunch of activities in the temple, and also where sages say, yeah, you know what? The giving of the Torah was in Shavuos. That's all. Then there are, I didn't even write it down, there are customs that people do based on different sources and so on. Customs like, for instance, eating dairy foods in the day of Shavuos, staying up all night, learning in the night of Shavuos. And some people have the custom of reading Ruth, the book of Ruth. Some people have the custom of putting flowers in the temple, in the synagogue, I mean. Not in the temple in Yerushalayim, in the synagogue. So all kinds of different interesting customs for Shavuos. But if you look again in the Torah, nothing. It doesn't say a word of what you should do in Shavuos except for whatever you have to do in the temple. So this is what Shavuos basically is all about. Now, having said that it is the Chag Matan Torah Seino, is the day, the holiday of the giving of the Torah, we have to understand who did the God give the Torah to. And a very simple answer is God gave the Torah to the Jewish people. They were those who were standing in the base of the mountain down there, and God appeared in the mountain and he gave the Torah. He pronounced the Ten Commandments all at once. There are all kinds of midrashim, explanations for our sages of actually what happened over there and what the people felt over there in the Talmud, the midrashim. Okay, very nice. You can actually find it. You Google what happened in the giving of the Torah, and you will see all kinds of interesting stories about it. But the main point that I want to bring down is that the Torah was given for the Jews. 600,000 men between 20 and 60 years old. Approximately more than 3 million people were actually standing over there in the Mount Sinai, that means down the mountain, and hearing God, seeing whatever they saw, listening to whatever they listened, and point. What about the non-Jews? Nothing. What about the non-Jews? Nothing. Who's talking about non-Jews? Nobody's talking about non-Jews. The whole process of the giving of the Torah was just for Jews. To the point, I wrote down an interesting midrash, and it gets more complicated. I cut out a few parts to make it simpler, but you can actually look it up. The sources are over there, Talmud Zvachim 116a, you can look it up. It's interesting. Our sages say that when God was giving the Torah to the Jewish people, His voice, God's voice, traveled all around the world. Everybody knew that something was happening. Something was happening. They didn't know exactly what, but something was happening. So they came, the kings came to the kings of the nations came to Bilam. Bilam was a prophet, a non-Jew prophet. There's a whole parsha called Balak that talks about the story of Bilam and Balak and so on. Bilam was a very special kind of prophet, not so good, so to speak. But people knew that he understood higher things. And he actually understood higher things. The Talmud says even that Bilam was the only one that knew the exact moment that God gets angry. And he tried to curse the Jews when God was angry. But for whatever reason, God knows why, he didn't get angry. So Bilam couldn't curse the Jews. But the point is that he knew hidden things. Let's call it that way. So they asked God, they asked Bilam, what is this tumultuous sound? What is this sound that we're listening to? Is God bringing another flood to destroy the world? That's what people asked Bilam. And he answered, no. He has a good and precious item in his treasury, said Bilam. He knew what the Torah was. That was hidden away with him for 974 generations before the world was created. And he seeks to give it to his children, the Jewish people. As it says, the Lord will give strength to his people. Hashem oiz le'amo iten. And some ends up saying, Hashem yavarech esavo v'shalom. God is going to give strength to his people, strength is Torah, and he's going to bless his children with his nation with peace. That's what the psalm says. So from here we see clearly that even the non-Jews understood that something was happening, and Bilam clearly explained to them, yeah, God is giving the Torah to Jews. In other words, even the non-Jews understood that God is giving the Torah to Jews, not to non-Jews. That's point number one. And when we say Torah, that God is giving the Torah, what we mean is God is giving the Ten Commandments together with the rest of the Torah, and that was given only to Jews. Like it? Fine. Don't like it? I'm so sorry. That's what our sages say. That's what the text of the Torah actually clearly says. Having said all of this, that doesn't mean that a non-Jew is left out, so to speak, of this whole thing, of Torah, of Judaism, of morality, of ethics, and so on. No, not at all. To the point that our sages say in the Talmud, that means the same Talmud that brings this story of Bilam, it's a different part of the Talmud, but it means it's the same book that brings this story of Bilam, talking to the non-Jews, brings the story of this idea of Rabbi Meir. And this is a known idea, known source. Rabbi Meir used to say that a non-Jew, you can read the English yourself, I'm not going to read the whole thing, a non-Jew learning Torah has the same spiritual level as a high priest that goes, a Jewish high priest, of course, that goes into the most innermost part of the temple, Kodesh HaKodashim Sanct, the most saint of saints, whatever you call it in English, doesn't matter, the most sacred part of the temple of the whole world, actually. So a non-Jew evidently has some relationship with the Torah. Why would a person that is not a high priest, is not even a priest, and between parentheses, I'm also not a priest, I'm not a Kohen, whatever, I'm a regular Jew, so I'm not talking bad about anybody else, but why would a non-Jew that is not a high priest, is not a priest, is not even a Jew, why would he be like a high priest when he learns Torah? And actually, the Rebbe explains in this particular source, Likutei Sichos, and we have classes on this, if I'm not mistaken, that it is the power, so to speak, of the Torah itself that elevates a person. When a person learns Torah, the power of Torah itself elevates a person to the level of a high priest. At least like a high priest, that's what the Talmud says, that's what Rabbi Meir says. Now, Does this apply to the whole Torah, as we're going to see in a few minutes? No, the truth is no. The Talmud itself says, I didn't copy it, but it does say in the same page, that this applies when a non-Jew is learning the seven commandments. Don't kill, don't steal, don't commit immorality with relationships, don't do idolatry, and so on. But the same commandments are not, the seven commandments, I'm sorry, I'm not just seven quote-unquote simple ideas and simple rules that anyone could keep, and most of people actually keep today, at least in this part of the Western world. No, the seven commandments are just like general rules that include inside of them or together with them so many without number ramifications and nuances and complexity and so on, that makes it a whole life of learning. And besides the learning itself, a whole life of applying it and really living with it, with this message, so to speak, of seven general rules that look, at least in the surface, very simple, but they're not so simple. I wish everybody would live like this, the world would be definitely different. Definitely different. Just to give one simple example, the Torah doesn't say that non-Jews should, actually talking about the Ten Commandments, honor parents. The Torah doesn't say that. One of the seven commandments is not to honor your parents. However, it is an obligation for non-Jews to honor the parents. The Rebbe says this so clearly. It's a long lesson, but the point is, yes, it is an obligation. Why? Because our sages say, and there are a few sources that say this, the Ramban says this, Rabbeinu Nissim Goin says this in his introduction to the Talmud, that every single rational idea that every human being would understand with his mind, that is a correct thing to do, like for instance, honoring parents, not lying, and so on, it is an obligation that the Torah imposes on the non-Jews also. So don't come to say, don't lie, it's not one of the seven, I can lie. No, you can't, I'm sorry. Hey, but it's not one of the seven. Doesn't make any difference, you can't. Because everybody knows that it is a rational thing that a society that everybody lies, you can't live like this. It's impossible. Okay, so having said all of this, we do see from this source that a person learning Torah, it is like a high priest. Okay, so on one hand, we say the Torah is not for the non-Jews. Then we say, well, wait a second. The Torah has the power to elevate a person into the level of a high priest when he's learning what he's supposed to be learning and so on. And then furthermore, not just being like a high priest, there's much more to that. There's something called Keser Torah in Hebrew over here. Keser Torah means the crown of the Torah. And there are a few sources. I just copied one of them. Actually, in Hebrew, you have one of them. And then there's another one. There's two sources over here. And there are others that basically say the same thing. But the idea is that our sages do say that the crown of Torah is Munach in Hebrew. Munach lechol bayo oilam. It's there sitting, so to speak, for every single human being. That's the precise language of our sages. And in another source that you can see it over here, you can read it by yourself, our sages discuss why was the Torah given in the desert? Like, wouldn't it be nicer that the Jewish people enter the land of Israel, a holy land, a nice land, and so on, and God gives the Torah to them over there? Yeah, but he didn't do it. He gave it in the desert, in a place that belongs to no one. Why? One of the explanations is, so anyone who asks, like wants Torah, may come and take it. Just as the desert belongs to nobody, you could go and whatever, do whatever you want, you could build your house over there. Okay, you're not going to do it because you don't have water, electricity, and the weather is terrible, but whatever. You could do it. It doesn't belong to anyone. Go to Africa, to the Sahara Desert, and nobody's going to say anything. Do whatever you want. So in the same way, by the Torah, every single human being can claim, so to speak, and go learn the Torah. Why? Because it was given in a place that doesn't belong to anyone. Wilderness, desert, and so on. So we do see from here, it's not just Torah and being like a high priest. The crown of Torah. Our sages explain that there are other crowns, also the crown of Malchus, kingship, the crown of priesthood. Okay, very nice. I personally don't have any of those crowns because I'm not a king, I'm not a priest, and so on. Okay, so at least go learn Torah. And a person learning Torah gets, so to speak, this crown of Torah. And this applies to non-Jews also, because the language of our sages is very precise. It says, non-Jews also. Called by a Olam, every single person in the world. So again, we see you're like a high priest. We see you can have the crown of Torah. Then, another source, the Rambam, Maimonides, it's very precise when he explains the laws. Here's the source, Laws of Kings. When he explains the laws of non-Jews towards the end of his book, Mishneh Torah, brings all the laws of the whole Judaism, all around the year, all around the ages, and so on. And at the end of the book, the very end is the laws of Mashiach. Before that, those two chapters talking about Mashiach, the Rambam talks about the non-Jews, which the Rebbe mentioned many times, that the fact that the Rambam brought these two laws together, the laws of the non-Jews, that means the message of Judaism for non-Jews, and then the laws of Mashiach, and furthermore, towards the end of the book, he could have brought it in like in the beginning, in the middle, whatever else. Okay, the non-Jews have to teach the Jews have to teach the non-Jews, blah, blah, blah. Whatever you have to teach. No, the Rambam brought it at the end, and together with Mashiach, that means that this is this action that we're doing actually right now, learning the laws of Judaism for non-Jews and so on, that's an act of bringing Mashiach. That's an act of preparation of the world for the bringing of Mashiach, for the whole objective of the whole creation. That's why the Rambam brought it together and by the end of the book. Like, this is the end of the work. This is the only, quote unquote, the only missing thing. It's not really 100% correct what I'm saying, but let's call it this way. It's one of the missing things that we still have to do in order to bring Mashiach. Okay. But by expressing this, the Rambam says something very clear and interesting. This is also a known source. The Torah was given, Torah mitzvahs were given to the Jews, to Israel, says the Rambam. As the Torah says, Torah is the inheritance of the congregation of Yaakov. Torah tzivalanu Moshe, Moirash, Akilas Yaakov, says the Torah by the end. Parshas Zoyis Abracha. The end of the Torah, this is the inheritance of the congregation of Yaakov. That means Jews. It doesn't mean non-Jews. And the same thing happened when, by the giving of the Torah, that's the connection that I want to make with Shavuos, as we're going to see in a minute, Moshe was commanded by the Almighty to compel all the inhabitants of the world to accept the commandments given to Noach's descendants. That means that in the moment of the giving of the Torah, God was not only thinking about the Jews, he was also thinking about the non-Jews, and he included in his message to Moshe Rabbeinu these seven commandments and the ramifications and so on. Now, the rest, I'm not going to read it, but what basically says, you can read it, of course. I don't want to be boring. Whatever. Let's move on. The rest says, basically, you have to keep these seven commandments because God gave them to Moshe Rabbeinu at Mount Sinai. That's basically what the Rambam brings. And if you do it because of that, okay, so you're a pious among the nations. And if you're not doing it, these commandments, because of that, you're not one of the pious among the nations, and you're not even a smart person. That's what the Rambam brings, which is interesting in itself. Why wouldn't it be a smart person if he's behaving like the Torah wants you to behave? But not because of the Torah, I'm just doing it because of my mind. My mind says so. The Rambam doesn't call you a smart person, a wise person. The reason is pretty simple, because a real wise person realizes, and understands that there's something higher than intellect. If you just live your life through or by your intellect, you're bound to mistakes. Because intellects also make mistakes. Why? Because after all, a human being, is accustomed to think about himself, herself. So you're always going to put yourself first. So you definitely, at one point or another point, you're going to end up making mistakes if you just place yourself in your intellect. So intellect itself understands that there's something beyond intellect. which is a subject in itself that has to be explained. That's not the idea today. If you later have questions, I can explain that. But the point is that why is a person not fulfilling the commandments because of the Torah? Rather, fulfilling the commandments because of his intellect. He's not called a wise person because he's only limited to his own intellect. He doesn't go beyond his own intellect, recognizing that there's a higher power, a superpower. The Rebbe used to call it the superpower, God Almighty. Okay, so let's go back just a second and let's see how we go back and forth and back and forth. Wait a second. The Torah was given to the Jews. The Torah was not given to the non-Jews. But a non-Jew learning Torah is like a high priest. And then he could even have the crown of Torah. If he really dedicates, or she dedicates, and so on. But then we said, no, wait a second. The Torah was given again, just for Jews, as the Rambam, like a law. This is the law. It's the inheritance of the congregation of Yaakov. It's not for non-Jews. Forget it. So wait a second. Is it for Jews and non-Jews, or just for Jews? I don't understand. So the idea is like this, pretty simple. The Talmud says this, it's not my invention. Talmud says this in Sanhedrin 59. Talmud says, when a person is, a non-Jew is learning the seven commandments and ramifications, yes, Torah is for all, and you're like a high priest, and you have the crown of Torah. Yeah, definitely. When the non-Jew is learning other parts of Torah that don't belong to them, wait a second, no, you're wrong. The Torah was given to Jews, and the Rambam says clearly, non-Jews are forbidden to learn Torah, and he doesn't even get into details what's permitted, when it's not permitted. He doesn't go into that. So a person has to focus, a non-Jew has to focus his learning to that which applies to his, her life. Okay, if you have questions exactly what to learn, that's a good question. You can ask a rabbi, of course. And the rabbi has to be able to tell you exactly which parts yes and which parts no and why. If he knows. And if he doesn't know, he can ask and so on. But that's basically the solution of this back and forth thing. Yes, when you learn your part, you're like a high priest. Okay, having said all of this, let's go to the Ten Commandments. Why do I say that the Ten Commandments are not for non-Jews? This part of the class is based on this commentary, which is actually also in English. You can look it up. Kli Yakar. He lived in Prague, 1600s. Efraim Alunchitz was his name. His commentary is very interesting in many, many places. He comments, of course, not just this. It's pretty long and interesting because he always brings something precious. Kli means like a vessel. Yakar means like a precious thing, like a precious stone. And sometimes, not always, but sometimes he finishes his commentary saying, yeah, what I just told you is like a Kli Yakar. It's like a precious stone, a precious a vessel, something really nice, right? Like supporting his own commentary. On this particular Parshas Yisroi in Shmois chapter 20, he brings a pretty long commentary. I recommend to read it all. It's interesting. I'm not going to do that with you, but it's interesting to read it all. You can find it in Sfaria. And he brings a commentary on the Ten Commandments. We know that the Ten Commandments actually appear twice in the Torah. Once, when the story actually happened, Parshas Yisroi, that's Shmois, chapter 20, and then Parshas Vayeshanan would be Dvarim, chapter 5. Parshas Vayeshanan, Moshe Rabbeinu repeating the Torah to the Jews before they entered the land of Israel, and so on. So we have two times, so to speak, in the Torah, the Ten Commandments. But the point is, the problem, quote-unquote, is that they're not exactly the same words, the original story and the repetition of the story. And if we're going to say that Moshe Rabbeinu forgot certain words or certain expressions of God from one time to the other, like around 38 years between the first time that Moshe Rabbeinu actually heard the Ten Commandments to the point that he repeated the Ten Commandments to the Jewish people, if you're going to say that he forgot or he changed something, we're in big trouble. Big trouble. Why? Because why can't you say the same thing on the rest of the Torah? Forget it. Moshe Rabbeinu heard whatever he heard. He made mistakes. He forgot. He changed. Like anybody, you know, I forgot. I didn't say it. Or I changed it. And that's it. The Torah is completely, completely irrelevant. Not important. Because maybe Moshe Rabbeinu made a mistake. So whatever you say that he said, who cares what he said? Maybe he made a mistake. So we can't say that. Therefore, we have to say that Moshe Rabbeinu made these changes on purpose, for some reason. And we have to understand why. And if you look at the commentaries, some of them in English, some of them are not in English, there are really, literally, I would say, tens and tens of commentaries on what are the differences between the first story of the Ten Commandments and the second story of the Ten Commandments. Why the differences and what they represent and so on. So the Kli Yakar, this Rabbi Ephraim Alunchitz, he is one of those commentaries that he brings one explanation of the differences. And this explanation is based on a very like revolutionary idea. Nobody says this, at least that I know. I don't know everything, but nobody says this. He says, you know what? The first version of the Ten Commandments was for the non-Jews. God had the intention to give the Torah to the non-Jews, and it is a known story that before giving the Torah to the Jews, God offered the Torah to other nations. For instance, the nation of Esav. Esav represents Rome and all of that. And they asked, what does it say in the Torah? One of the commandments of the Torah says, Lo-tirzach, you can't murder. And Esav said, no, wait a second. We live on this. We can't. I don't care. I don't want this Torah. And then he went to the children of Ishmael, the son of Abraham, Ishmael. And he also asked, what does it say in the Torah? Or they also asked, what does it say in the Torah? Don't steal. And they said, no, we live on this. We live stealing. So we can't accept this Torah. We don't want it. And then he went to the children of Ammon and Moab, the daughters of Lot. Ammon and Moab. What does it say in the Torah? Don't do adultery. And they said, wait a second, we were born out of incest. Or the daughters of Lot had relationships with Lot, and that's a whole story in Parshas Vayera. So, no, we live on this. No, forget it. We don't want your Torah. To the point that he went to every single nation in the world. Nobody wanted the Torah. He went to the Jews, and the Jews didn't ask. Some say there's a joke, stupid joke, actually. Jews said, give me, how much does it cost? Zero, so give me two. That's why two tablets. It's a stupid joke. But the point is, that the Jews didn't ask what it says over there. They said, Na'aseh v'nishma. Yeah, we will do everything that it says over there, and we will try to understand it, learn, whatever, listen, and so on. And this is such a, again, revolutionary idea that the Talmud itself brings a story of a sage discussing with a non-Jew, and the non-Jew told the sage, you're Amma Paziza. That's what he says to him. Like, your nation, the Jews, your nation is a nation of people that rush to the things. You're stupid, you rush. You go everything fast, come on. You see, before even knowing what the Torah says, you already said, give it to me. You don't even know what you're actually committing to. You're stupid people. Oh, whatever, that's a story. So that means that it's something interesting. So let's go back. The Kli Yakar, the Ephraim Alunchitz, says the first version of the Ten Commandments was given actually to the non-Jews. That's what God offered the non-Jews. When they rejected it, so God said, okay, I'll change the version and I'll give it to my people. And he offered to the Jews, and the Jews accepted. And throughout the commentary, we're going to see a few details of this whole commentary, which is a long one. Just a few details. But all along the commentary, he brings clearly how the version offered to the Jews is much more harder to keep than the version offered to the non-Jews. Like, he made a cheap deal, so to speak, for the non-Jews. Take this one. What do you say? Of course, they said no. So, okay, forget it. So I'm going to go with everything for the Jews, which is much more difficult than what he offered to the non-Jews. So let's see. First one, which is a very controversial point, which is very interesting. The Torah says one of the commandments is Zachor is Yom HaShabbos. You should remember, that's what it says in the first version. You should remember the day of Shabbos. In the second version, when Moshe Rabbeinu repeated the Torah, it says Shomer is Yom HaShabbos. You should keep, guard, observe the day of Shabbos. Again, the first version says Zachor, you should remember. The second version says Shomer. You should actually observe it. And our sages bring an explanation very interesting that both words, Zachar and Shamar, were said at the same time by God. Something which is impossible for us to pronounce two words at the same time, exactly. Not one after the other, like two words at the same time, it's impossible. But that's what God said. Zachar and Shamar, v'diburecha nemru, they were said together. But according to this commentary, he brings a very interesting difference. He says like this, look, the Talmud says clearly that a non-Jew keeping Shabbat, the Rambam brings it down also as a law, non-Jew keeping Shabbat has death penalty. But he should remember Shabbat. What does it mean to remember Shabbat? It means to be conscious that God created the world in 6 days, and the seventh day he rested. He did not command the non-Jews to rest. Not at all. Like, you want to rest? Go sleep the whole day if you want. I don't care. But there's no commandment of resting in a particular day of the week. Interestingly, it's not the halacha, it's not the law, but the Rashi, Rabbi Shlomo Yitzchak in France, has a very strict opinion. Non-Jews cannot rest. That's what he says, basically. But whatever, that's not the law. The point is that the Kli Yakar, this commentary that we're learning, says, very simple. If God would have told the non-Jews to rest in Shabbos, like the Jews do, it would have been so difficult, they would have said, no, of course, it's just, forget it. I have to work, I have to make money, I have to, whatever. So that's why he didn't bring that in the first version of the commandments. He just, God just said, Zachar, you should remember this. And he brings, and it is an obligation, even today, so to speak, for non-Jews to remember the day of Shabbos. What does that mean? Again, the main point is to know, to be conscious, that the world is not an eternal thing, like some philosophers used to think, and some people even think it today. Some scientists also think this today, but whatever. In Judaism, we say no. The world is a quote-unquote a new thing, something that God created. And this is reminded to us by the day of Shabbos. God created the world in 6 days, and the seventh he rested. And just to add, interesting, this is also connected. The Rebbe says this, and we actually learned this in other classes, but the Rebbe connects this idea to prayer also. Since there's the existence of God, which is part of the idea of an entity, let's call it God, but whatever, an entity creating the world. The world is not an eternal thing. The physical world is not an eternal thing. It's something created. So there's a creator, which is a superpower, almighty, and so on, that also brings together prayer, praises to him, and trust. The Rebbe says, very interesting, trust, bitachon, trusting God. That's part of the whole story, so to speak, of not doing idolatry and tied, so to speak, together with the idea of Shabbos. But in the second version of the commandments, God said, no, but that's not really what I want. What I want is my people, Jewish people, to keep Shabbos. That means don't do the works and don't do this and don't do that and blah, blah, blah. We're not going to learn the laws of Shabbos. And that's why in the second version, it does say that. Yeah, the second tablets also. It does say that. Shomer, you should guard the Shabbos, not just remember it. Just in case, so nobody misunderstands, I'm not saying, clearly not saying, that a non-Jew should do what is called kiddush. Take a cup of wine and recite a blessing because God gave the Torah or whatever. God created the world in 6 days. No. That's not what I'm saying. No religious ceremonies in Shabbos for non-Jews. It's wrong. You would be creating a religion. You would be doing something, I'm sorry, that is completely wrong. And even if you read the text of the Kiddush, you will see that it's talking about the Jews. So it doesn't make any sense. You're saying lies, whatever. It doesn't make any sense. What I'm saying is, be conscious. You want to say Tehillim, you want to read Psalms, it's okay. You want to rest, it's okay. You want to even make a meal together with your family and say, today we're going to make a meal because we're together and God created the world in 6 days and the seventh he rested. That's okay. You could do that. But not religious ideas that the Jews do, copy them and do it on Shabbat. That's wrong. But whatever, that's difference number one. Again, the first time it says Zachar, because that's an easier one. Just remember it. And that's what God offered the non-Jews. And they didn't accept that. So, okay, so he offered the whole package, so to speak, for the Jews. Let's move on to another idea. When we continue reading the Ten Commandments, it says, as God has commanded you, kasher tzivcha Hashem Elokecha. In the second version of the Ten Commandments, you will see that it appears like 2-3 times. Do this like I commanded you. Shabbos, regarding Shabbos, it says, like I commanded you. Regarding honoring parents, it says, like I commanded you. But in the first version of the Ten Commandments, it doesn't say that. It doesn't say, no, commanded you. Why did Moshe Rabbeinu added these words? Why did he add these words? And what the commentary we're learning explains is very simple. Because the first version was for the non-Jews. And God never told the non-Jews to keep Shabbos or to remember Shabbos. He just said it in that particular time. Or to honor the parents and so on. But for the Jews, even before the giving of the Torah, in a place called Mara, that's what it's called, in Parshas Beshalach, that's the story, God gave commandments to the Jews. One of them was Shabbos. Another of them was honoring parents. And then there were others also. For instance, dinim, laws, like commercial laws, and also the idea of para aduma, the red heifer, whatever. But these two particular commandments that appear actually in the Ten Commandments, Shabbos and honoring parents, God gave to the Jews before even the Ten Commandments. He just repeated them in the Ten Commandments. So in the first version that was for the non-Jews, it doesn't say like I commanded you, because he never commanded them. In the second version, God is saying basically, hey, do you remember? I already told you this, to keep Shabbos. I already told you to honor your parents. That's why there's an addition over there in the second commandments, the second version of the commandments. The same thing happens when you see in the second version of the commandments, it does say that you should honor, for instance, your father and your mother, that you may long endure, like you will have a long life. You will have a long life if you do this. Honor your parents, you will have a long life. And in the first version, it doesn't say that. It doesn't say that. Why not? Because the truth is, this is what the commentary brings, that this idea of the long life is not talking about this particular world. Not at all. Actually, there's a midrash. I don't remember all the details of the midrash. But it's a very hard one, tough one. I mean, it says, the idea that I remember, that the Torah sometimes says you will have long life if you do certain commandments. For instance, honoring parents. This midrash is really talking about Shiluach HaKan. When you see, the details don't really matter, but when you see a bird and you want the small children of the birds, so you have to send away the mother and then you keep the children and so on. And the Torah says you will have long life if you do this. And the midrash brings a hard story. A person puts a ladder and goes up the ladder to take these babies, whatever they called, I don't know, the small birds, and you kick out the mother, and you take the birds, and you fall from the ladder, and you die. The person died. Where's the long life? Where's the long life? What do you mean? I just did something, and the Torah says I'm going to have a long life, and now I just died. So, based on this idea, our sages say the long life is talking about the world to come. It's not talking about this world. Don't think you're going to have more years of physical, material life because you do this mitzvah or that mitzvah. Forget it. That's not what it's talking about. It's the same thing happens with honoring father and mother in the Ten Commandments in the second version. You will have a long life, says the Torah. That it's not talking about this world. It's talking about the world to come. But in the first version of the Ten Commandments, the Torah doesn't even say a long life. Why? Because when God offered this first version of the Ten Commandments to the non-Jews, you can't just say, you will have a long life in the world to come. What? How do you eat this? Is going to fill my pockets with dollars or not? Then I don't want it. I don't care. Give me something I can actually understand. If you're going to reward me, give me a reward in this world, not the world to come. But that's why it doesn't say in the first version of the Ten Commandments, honor your father and mother, that you will have a long life, long endure, or whatever. No. God didn't want to talk about that to the non-Jews. Doesn't make any sense. They would not accept it at all. So he made it easier for them, so to speak. Just two more ideas on this. When it says in the second version, you have to be like very precise. And you, with this, you can see how far, so to speak, our sages go into explaining even a letter. In the first version of the Ten Commandments, you will see the second five, so to speak, Leitirzach, Leitinav, Leitignoi. It says a whole list of don'ts. Don't do adultery, don't commit adultery, don't steal, don't kill, and so on. The second version says basically the same thing, but with one change. There's that one more letter. Don't commit adultery, and don't do this, and don't do that. In Hebrew, and, it's just one letter, vav. There's an additional letter over there. So why an additional letter? We're saying that the first version was for the non-Jews, and the second version was for the Jews. Why in the version for the Jews, God decided to add one letter before one of these don'ts, each one of these don'ts? So the commentary explains like this. This added letter alludes to the prohibition of promiscuity with an unmarried woman. When the Torah says in the Ten Commandments, don't commit adultery, there's a very specific definition of what adultery means. And actually, between parentheses, the Christians took this particular commandment and they explained whatever they wanted to explain. It's completely wrong. Completely wrong. It doesn't mean don't have relationships whenever you want, to say it in a simple way. It means specifically adultery. What's the definition of adultery in Judaism? The whole definition is complex for many reasons. I'm going to say it, and if somebody has a question, you can ask. But the definition of adultery is a married woman cannot be with another man. Point. That's what it means, adultery in Judaism. But wait a second. What happened if he is married and he wants to be with another woman? Is that called adultery? Okay. For modern society, yes. For Torah, no. Why? What's the difference? We're all the same and so on. No, yeah. For point number one, we're not all the same. Point number two, a man could technically, practically no, but technically be married to more than one woman. So it's not adultery if he's with another woman. Maybe he married another woman. What's the problem? I have three wives, four wives, five wives. Today, that's forbidden for many reasons. There's a whole story. If a person wants to know more details to this, I invite you to look up the story of Rabbeinu Gershon, Me'ora Goyla, that's what it was called, year 900s, Germany. He is the one that actually invited all the Western world Jews not to marry more than one woman. He suffered so much. He married two and he suffered so much. He said, that's it. I don't want anyone else to suffer the whatever I suffered. That's it. Only one woman. And that's how we all live. Besides the fact that in most of Western countries, it's forbidden to marry more than one. So going back just to the plain Torah law, a man could marry more than one woman. Now, having said that, who told you you cannot have relationships with an unmarried woman? Unmarried woman. If she's married, oops, that's adultery. Don't do that. But if she's not married, yeah, but you're married to your wife. Yeah, but who's forbidding me? Who's not allowing me to be with another woman? What's the problem? So for the Jews, God gave a version very strict with another additional letter. The additional letter is telling us, hey, with an unmarried woman, you cannot do whatever you want. No, go marry. You want to marry? Okay, go marry 10 women if you want. Okay. David HaMelech married 6. Shlomo HaMelech married 1,000, and that's how he ended up. But the problem is that for the Jew, God is saying, don't do whatever you want with an unmarried woman, even though it's not forbidden, technically speaking. Don't do that. For the non-Jew, he did not have the word, the letter vav. Just another letter. This letter is not there. Because the non-Jews would have said, no, forget it. If she's not married, what's the problem? If she's married, okay, that's adultery. I don't want that. But if she's not married, what's the problem? Okay, so God didn't have this letter. Same thing happens with another of these last commandments, but also has in the second version another letter that the explanation is basically the same, more strict for the Jew and not so strict for the non-Jew. In this particular case, don't be false witness. It's not just false witness. It's just deception in general. Don't deceive people. Don't lie. Don't go around the world saying one thing and doing another thing. Don't do that. In the second version, there's another letter saying, not just false witness, don't deceive people. But in the first version, it doesn't say that. That doesn't mean, don't misunderstand, that non-Jews could deceive people and lie and so on. No. No, definitely not. But what I'm saying is, when God offered the Ten Commandments for the non-Jews originally, before the Jews, it allowed, so to speak, more leniencies. It was an easier Ten Commandments. They did not accept not even that first version. Forget it. None of this is for you. You rejected it. Okay. This is for the Jews. Of course, I think I didn't see this written anywhere, but I think it has to be said anyway. A person might ask, particularly a non-Jew that wants to follow the message and the Bnei Noach and blah, 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 all of this that we all know about, might say, but wait a second, I was not asked. I wasn't there. It's not my fault. Some stupid guy 3,000 years ago said no, and that's why I don't have the Ten Commandments. What's the problem? It's not my fault. I want this. Okay. The truth is, we're not talking about a person over here. God did not offer the Torah to a physical person saying this or that. Doesn't make any sense. Gather all the non-Jews from every single corner of the world. Okay, God can do anything he wants, but still, it doesn't make much sense. The idea is that he offered to the angels that manage each one of the 70 nations, and the angels, they decided they didn't want this. And again, the question is the same. It's not my fault. And the answer is pretty simple. Most of the ideas of the Ten Commandments do apply to non-Jews, but not because they are stated in the Ten Commandments. No, for different reasons, from different places, either as a rational commandment, either as a moral thing, moral obligation, or because it's learned from other, like a ramification, a derivative from other mitzvahs, and so on. So most of the ideas actually do apply. But just to say, the idea of saying, I want the Ten Commandments, it's a problem. Because it says Shabbos over there. And the Talmud says clearly, Shabbos is not for non-Jews. So you can't accept, so to speak, upon yourselves the Ten Commandments and say, this is also for me, I want it. Some stupid angel said no 3,000 years ago, I want it anyway for me. No, I'm sorry. It's a wrong path, so to speak. And a person always has to ask himself, herself, do I want to do what I like or do I want to do what God likes? That's the main question a person has to ask himself. If you really want to do what God likes, what his will, so to speak, so go find out, ask, investigate, ask a rabbi and so on, and he will tell you, like, this is what God wants for the Jews and for the non-Jews and so on. Ah, you don't like it? So you have to ask yourself, what are you seeking? What are you looking for? Again, yourself or God? That's a general question a person has to ask. So the commentary of the Kli Yakar brings much more explanations, but they're basically the same spirit, so to speak. The first version of the Ten Commandments was like a lighter version, much easier version, permissible version, and the second version is much harder because the first one was for the non-Jews, they rejected it, and the second one is for the Jews. And we accepted it. Now, interestingly, I'm just going back a second and then we'll finish the class with Shavuos. Interestingly, this particular source of the Rambam, okay, you don't have to read the whole thing, don't worry. The Rambam is saying that God gave the Torah for the Jews and together with the giving of Torah, there's a message for the non-Jews. It's an important source. Besides the fact that the Rambam says the non-Jews should not learn Torah, should not keep Shabbos. Okay, that's what the Talmud says, and the Rambam just copies it into law. But it's an important source because, again, within the message given for Jews, there's a message for the Jews to share certain parts of the message for the non-Jews, with the non-Jews. So it's literally an obligation, and actually to the point that Rambam says that God asked to compel Jews, to compel all the inhabitants of the world, and so on. So it's part of Judaism, so to speak. A person can't come and say, where you got these seven commandments from? No. It's part of our tradition. Having said all of this, okay, Shavuos comes, and we already explained 10 commandments are not for the non-Jews. They rejected it, and even though they have a message, okay, but the message is hidden, so to speak, in different parts of the Torah, has to be clarified with authorities and rabbis and so on. Okay, what can a non-Jew do in Shavuos? Point number one, Jews don't do much in Shavuos. They just pray, and that's it. As I explained before, there's not like really much to do. We don't eat matzah, and we don't have a sukkah, and whatever. We don't have any, we don't fast. We don't have any of these things we have in different holidays. As I said before, there are customs. So if a non-Jew wants to eat cheesecake the day of Shavuos, be happy. Eat the cheesecake. Is this a religious practice? What's religious about eating cheesecake? I don't think any religious thing in eating cheesecake. But if it happens that you don't like cheesecake, but you heard that the Jews are eating cheesecake, don't eat cheesecake. Yeah, but the Jews eat cheesecake. But if you don't like it, what are you doing? Like, are you crazy? Where's the mitzvah of eating something you don't like? And cheesecake is just an example, of course, just one example. Whatever, you don't like dairy, or dairy, it's dangerous for you. There's some certain people that are allergic to dairy. So don't eat it. Yeah, but the Jews eat in Shavuos. No. Don't eat it. Don't eat it. So it's not about food, exactly what to eat or what not to eat. That's not the point in Shavuos. To go hear the Ten Commandments in the synagogue, okay, let's see if the synagogue is going to allow you to go in. I don't know. So in each place of the world where you live, you're going to have to ask the rabbi whether you can actually go and hear them. Are you obligated to do that? No, not at all. Yeah, but I want to relive them. Wait a second, what do you want to relive? What? You weren't there. It might sound kind of hard, but the truth is, I just explained through a whole class, you were not there. So you're not reliving anything, and you're not living anything. It's not for you. So why should you go? You want to go? Be happy if they let you in. But if they don't let you in, don't feel bad. Don't feel left out. That has no relationship with you. Not at all. So what? Yes. To do. It's an interesting moment to understand and to know this source that I just brought at the end again of the Rambam, that particular time is the time that God gave the seven commandments and the ramifications to the Jews to share with the non-Jews. So to be thankful to God that you actually have a framework, so to speak, where to live within the will of God. To call it in some place, in some way. You have to know, you can contemplate and think that particular day is the day that God gave us a mission, a very specific mission of revealing his godliness in the world. So you can ask yourself, and you can contemplate and think about yourself, am I fulfilling this mission? Am I living up to it? Like, am I really doing my best effort to this and for this? Am I really learning Torah as much as I could? Am I really learning what I can learn? Of course, and this is something for every single day, not just for Shavuos, think about how the world is constantly recreated by God. And of course, you can read Psalms. Some people in the Jewish world read, like in Chabad, we don't do this, but some people read the book of Ruth, because Ruth actually is connected to Shavuos through the crops of wheat. So she was there gathering wheat and so on. So it's connected to Shavuos. And also another connection is that Ruth was the great-grandmother of David HaMelech. And David HaMelech passed away in Shavuos. So some people read the book of Ruth, completely acceptable. And again, as I said before with the cheesecake, is this a religious act to read the book of Ruth? I don't see the religious act. You could read it every day if you want. It's not a problem. You want to read it in Shavuos? It's okay. Go read it in Shavuos. Of course, you could read the Torah, where it talks about the Ten Commandments, the first version, the second version. You can read the commentary of Kli Yakar. It's very interesting. You can look it up. It's available in English again. It's in Sefaria. But religious observances, I don't think are correct. I don't think are correct. But again, I repeat this. Even for Jews, there are not many religious observances in Shavuot. You want to stay up all night learning. Okay, you want to stay up all night learning, you can stay up all night learning. What's the problem? There's no problem. But not because the religious, no, because you want to stay up all night learning, which is okay. It's completely, completely acceptable. So having said all of this, we have to be thankful to God that we do have a Torah, because actually angels complain to God, don't give the Torah to the human beings, don't give the Torah to the Jewish people. And there's a whole story about how Moshe Rabbeinu actually argued with the angels, and he brought down the Torah for us. We have to be thankful. Every single human being can be thankful that we do have the Torah, and that allows us and gives us, as I mentioned before, a framework to connect to godliness, to connect to our own souls, to our own essence. And basically, that's why Shavuos doesn't have anything. Pesach, you have matzah. Okay, the matzah, go with matzah. And Sukkot, you do the hot and so on. And in Rosh Hashanah, the shofar, and then you keep it, you fast. Very nice. In Shavuos, you don't do anything. What does that mean? It means that it's connection to God. That's all. It doesn't have a shape. When you put a shape into something, you limit that something. In Pesach, matzah. In Sukkot, the hot. So the connection has a limit, a way, a shape, a form. Shavuos is just connection to God, to His essence. It doesn't have any shape, doesn't have any form. It's just you and Him. That's all. That's why it doesn't have a particular observance, so to speak. So let's hope that for this Shavuos, each one of us can actually contemplate on these ideas. And I wish Jews would contemplate on these ideas also. Whatever, we do all the observances and we don't contemplate anything. Okay, I finished. That's it. I'm going to sleep. I stayed up all night. I'm so tired. I'm going to sleep. So you spend the whole show with sleeping. Okay, no much contemplation. But whatever, let's hope for a meaningful Shavuos.